KSDP 830 AM Sandpoint, K201DA King Cove, KFPS False Pass.
Good morning. European leaders hold an emergency meeting today to support Ukraine. How much did the U.S. change the game by pausing military aid and intelligence? We place a call to Kyiv in this hour of Morning Edition from NPR News. President Trump's call to increase deportations is causing panic for some. I'm Martinez.
And I'm Steve Inskeep. A North Carolina hotline aims to inform people if immigration agents are near. It also warns against false alarms, which are numerous. The Trump administration is dropping a lawsuit against Idaho's abortion ban, so local hospitals are picking it up. And a woman figures out how to be alone after divorce. It's Thursday, March 6th. This day in 1912, the National Biscuit Company introduced Oreo cookies, first sold by a grocer in Hoboken, New Jersey. Have some milk, too. The news is next.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Corva Coleman. President Trump's 25% tariffs are in effect on imported goods from Canada and Mexico, but he has given a one-month reprieve to the big three U.S. automakers. The high tariff rates are still in place for nearly all other goods. The tariffs affect many industries. Jack Vesey is a produce grower in California. He says so far he has not seen any losses.
Any type of tariff or trade war, there's winners and losers. There's certain things that, you know, might be a positive for us. There may be some things that might be negatives. Concern on fertilizer price and some of our inputs. You know, if those increase, that's going to put a damper on things. That's going to increase our cost.
Meanwhile, Canadian Prime Minister Justin Trudeau says that he expects Canada and the U.S. to be in a trade war for the foreseeable future. Billionaire Elon Musk continues to oversee President Trump's efforts to overhaul the federal government with his Doge entity. Musk has stated an ambitious goal to cut $1 trillion in federal spending by the end of this fiscal year in September. But as NPR Stephen Fowler reports, any major changes of that magnitude are supposed to be driven by Congress, not Doge.
For every dollar the federal government has spent so far since the start of this fiscal year in October 2024, Doge has claimed to save the equivalent of about 4 pennies. An NPR review finds those savings claims from actions like pushing agencies to fire workers and cut contracts are drastically inflated. But even if you take those numbers at face value, Doge's focus is on such a small part of the multi-trillion dollar federal budget handled by Congress. About two-thirds of this year's federal spending has been on Social Security, Medicare, health programs, income security, and veterans benefits and services. Most of what's left goes towards interest on the debt and defense. Stephen Fowler, NPR News, Atlanta.
Members of Congress grilled mayors from four Democratic cities yesterday for hours. They questioned the mayors about their policies concerning people who are illegally in the United States. NPR's Jimena Bustillo reports the mayors defended their use of taxpayer dollars to address the needs in their cities.
The mayors of Chicago, Boston, Denver, and New York were summoned to Washington to defend their so-called sanctuary city policies. Those policies generally limit local law enforcement from participating in federal immigration and customs enforcement activity. Supporters argue this preserves trust in local law enforcement and leaves federal law enforcement to federal agencies. Critics say there's a lack of cooperation bordering on obstruction and at odds with President Trump's goals to increase deportations. The Democratic mayors also said that much of their recent policy has been in response to Republican governors sending recently arrived migrants to their cities on buses. Jimena Bustillo, NPR News.
On Wall Street, the Dow is down about 150 points. The Nasdaq is down about 1%. You're listening to NPR News from Washington. The House has voted to censure Texas Democratic Congressman Al Green. He stood up and criticized President Trump on Tuesday during Trump's address to a joint session of Congress. Trump claimed that he had a mandate from voters. Green said he did not have a mandate to cut Medicaid. When Green was ordered to sit down, he refused and then was removed from the chamber. Green says he would do it again. The Republican-led House has now voted to censure Green. The Democrat is a former president of the Houston NAACP. Barnes & Noble workers in three stores in New York have reached a union contract with the company. This marks the first collective bargaining deal in the nation for the bookstore chain. NPR's Alina Selyukh has more.
Barnes & Noble has been expanding in the past 2 years, and some workers have pushed to unionize. They've succeeded so far at 7 locations. At 3 of them, the union and the company have now reached their first ever collective bargaining contract, a deal on pay and benefits like wage increases and new safety measures, including anti-slip mats in the cafe and paid car rides for late-night shifts. That's according to the Retail, Wholesale and Department Store Union, which represents workers at these stores. All of them are in New York City, including the Barnes & Noble flagship store. The union says a 4th location is expected to ratify its contract this weekend in Bloomington, Illinois. Alina Selyukh, NPR News.
The Vatican says Pope Francis had a quiet night and remains in stable and guarded condition. He continues to rest in the Rome hospital where he is being treated for pneumonia. I'm Corva Coleman, NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include Capital One with the Capital One Saver Card. What's in your wallet? Terms apply. Details at CapitalOne.com. And the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation at MacFound.org.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Steve Inskeep in Washington, D.C.
And I'm A. Martinez in Los Angeles, California. How much did the U.S. change the game by pausing military aid and intelligence to Ukraine? We place a call to Kyiv to find out. But first, European leaders are gathering for an emergency summit to coordinate support for Ukraine.
They're aiming to protect against Russia and do it with less help from the United States. The U.S., to be clear, remains part of the NATO alliance with troops based in Germany. But in recent days, the U.S. paused military supplies and intelligence sharing with Ukraine, bidding to force a peace with Russia.
Terry Schultz is in Brussels covering the meeting. Terry, what's the mood like there?
Good morning. Well, you can really feel the worry here in a way I haven't seen since Russia's full-scale invasion of Ukraine started 3 years ago. And interestingly, that isn't because Moscow's doing anything differently. It's been relentlessly attacking Ukraine since the beginning of the war. The difference is this rapid deterioration of relations between the Trump administration and Ukraine, the spat between the presidents in the Oval Office last week, and as you mentioned, the subsequent suspension of military assistance and now intelligence sharing, which is essential to Ukraine on the battlefield.
So there was an urgent meeting in Paris. There was an urgent meeting in London, now one in Brussels. So outside of it being all urgent, what are European leaders actually going to do about this?
Well, today I expect leaders to move forward. Now, whether they can reach the required unanimity yet is unclear, but there's a new package of proposals on how they can come up with 800 billion euros. That's more than $860 billion in defense spending. That would be partly in loans backed up by the EU for buying new weapons, and partly by setting aside EU penalties on having too much debt so that governments can now drastically increase their military spending.
Okay, so are European citizens on board with that?
Well, yeah, going into more debt isn't popular, but I spoke with former Dutch Defense Minister Kaisa Ollengren about this, and she said that politicians and officials just need to help their people understand that U.S. unpredictability means it's urgent now to mobilize all the tools they have available to scale up both their domestic defense and support for Ukraine.
If you boil it down, I think it comes down to turning the European economy into a war economy. These are difficult choices, and you have to explain them to people, but it has to be done.
Now, earlier suggestions to declare a war economy in Europe didn't get traction because many leaders felt it was too drastic and would unnecessarily scare people. So you can see how things have changed.
Yeah, it certainly sounds like Europeans have kind of moved into this worst case scenario thinking, when it comes to regarding U.S. support.
Well, they're at least seriously considering those scenarios, including researcher Giuseppe Spadafora with the EU Institute of Security Studies. He told me that even the fear of the U.S. disengaging could destabilize the transatlantic relationship further.
The U.S. could use the threat of abandonment as a tool to obtain a lot of concessions in areas that weaken Europe. It could force Europeans to compromise on a lot of other areas, such as trade concessions, changing technology standards, and curtailing certain rights.
So Spadafora says Europeans' concern about this possibility may end up leading them to make policy decisions in favor of the Trump administration.
So if the U.S. does indeed step back, as people are worried about, are there individual European leaders looking to maybe step up?
Well, French President Emmanuel Macron has really tried to be that leader. And as the head of one of two nuclear powers in Europe, he has a lot of weight in defense issues. So in an evening address, he said he'll call together European army chiefs to discuss a potential peacekeeping force and says he's even considering extending the French nuclear deterrent over the rest of Europe.
L'avenir de l'Europe n'a pas à être tranché à Washington ou à Moscou.
The future of Europe does not have to be decided in Washington or Moscow, he said. So EU leaders hope to decide some things about their future here in Brussels today.
All right, that's Terry Schultz in Brussels. Terry, thanks.
You're welcome.
Let's review the order of some recent events. President Trump and Vice President Vance berated Zelensky in the White House, saying, among other things, that he argued too much and failed to say thank you in that particular meeting. The U.S. paused military aid to Ukraine. Zelensky then said publicly the confrontation had been regrettable and that he was on board with a minerals deal and everything else the U.S. wanted. President Trump said he received a nice letter from Zelensky. And then we learned the U.S. also had paused intelligence sharing with Ukraine. How does all this look from Kyiv? Robert Hamilton is here. He's the head of Eurasia Research at the Foreign Policy Research Institute, and he's in the Ukrainian capital. Welcome to the program.
Morning, Steve. Good to be with you.
How are people there responding to the news?
Well, so people here in Kyiv are, of course, confused, frustrated, and a little worried. What it looks like here, and frankly, what it looks like to me as well, is the U.S. is putting pressure on Ukraine, the victim of this war, while making unilateral concessions to Russia, the aggressor.
And when you say unilateral concessions, that's things like making public statements that obviously Russia is going to get to keep Ukrainian territory and that sort of thing, right?
Exactly. Like before the U.S. even sat down at the table with the Russians in Saudi Arabia for the first meeting, U.S. officials were making statements to the effect that Ukraine should give up on the idea of recovering its territorial integrity and should give up on the idea of NATO membership. Now, leave aside the fact that it would be difficult militarily for Ukraine to recover its territorial integrity and that NATO membership, although it's been NATO policy since 2008, is still a sticky question for the 32 allies, but you don't give those away as unilateral concessions before you ever sit down with your interlocutor. Those are things that you may give away during a negotiation, but when you give it away before a negotiation starts, you just shrunk the bargaining space and moved it in the direction of your adversary. So you just ensured that whatever negotiation, whatever it yields, will be far more in the interest of the adversary.
Now, I guess we should note the administration's point of view is they were just stating the obvious. Obviously, Ukraine's not going to recover its territory and that sort of thing. But now we have this recent chain of developments. How vital was the loss of intelligence sharing, which we learned about even after Zelensky had said he was on board with the administration?
Yeah, I think that's the most important, and as I think you correctly call it, vital. It will have immediate effects, and it'll have immediate effects in terms of lost Ukrainian lives. Two pieces of U.S. intelligence sharing are critical to Ukraine's ability to resist. The first is early warning of missile strikes. The U.S. can see missiles much quicker than the Ukrainians can, and so it gives Ukrainians more time to react and to get to cover, both civilians and military. The inability of Ukraine to target Russian command and control logistics and reserve formations, it was getting targeting data from the U.S. that allowed it to interdict Russian rear areas, which made it harder for Russia to press its advantage on the front. Now, that will stop as well.
Is it clear to Ukrainians what it is the United States wants from Ukraine that Ukraine has not already at least said they would deliver?
It's not. Ukraine has said, President Zelensky here has said, the only thing that he's really, his only red line is some sort of post-ceasefire security guarantees, some sort of arrangement that gives Ukraine some confidence that Russia will not resume the war as soon as it's ready. And that's why in the Oval Office, Zelensky, when J.D. Vance started saying, we need to let diplomacy work, Zelensky started down the litany of all the diplomatic agreements that Ukraine and its partners, to include the U.S., had signed with Russia that the Russians had broken, culminating in the full-scale invasion of February 2022.
Some people around President Trump have talked of replacing Zelensky in some way. What are Zelensky's supporters and opponents making of that?
Well, one thing I'll say about the Friday meeting in the Oval Office is Zelensky's popularity here is far, far stronger than it was before the meeting. You know, polls here, they don't often ask directly, do you support the president? They ask confidence and trust. And the latest polls I was able to find before the Oval Office meeting was about 57% support for Zelensky. It's certainly higher now, maybe 20 to 30%. We'll have to see when the next polls are taken. But he got a huge bump in popularity. And Ukrainians really rallied around him and rallied around their country. They felt like the attack on Zelensky was an attack on their country.
Just to be clear, when you say 20 to 30%, you mean you think the approval is 20 to 30% higher than it was before, overwhelming majority?
Exactly, yeah.
Okay. All right, thanks very much for the insights. That's Robert Hamilton, head of Eurasia Research at the Foreign Policy Research Institute, and he's in Kyiv.
Sesame Workshop has started layoffs, including content creators and executives. The news comes a couple of months after Warner Brothers Discovery said it would no longer pay for new episodes of Sesame Street after 2025 and following an attempt by 200 employees to unionize. Here's NPR's Elizabeth Blair.
It's more like foul weather on Sesame Street right now. In a statement, Sesame Workshop says it's reducing the size of the organization to ensure that it can, quote, deliver on its mission for years to come.
All right, the song's over. Now get lost.
The media landscape is tough right now. Kids have a gazillion choices, from unboxing videos on YouTube to the hit cartoon Bluey.
The traditional kids' media business has been massively disrupted.
Gary Nell is a media consultant and former president and CEO of Sesame Workshop and NPR. He says Sesame Street's secret sauce has always been its educational pedigree.
The seriousness of impact, teaching letters and numbers or certain outcomes for kids so that they retain knowledge, and those are expensive.
One of the people laid off yesterday was Phoebe Gilpin. She was the senior director of formal learning.
My content is specifically focused on schools.
Gilpin was one of the employees who wanted to form a union. Many of her colleagues, like writers and puppeteers, are already in unions. Gilpin says CEO Sherry Weston told staff that 20% of the workforce was being laid off. A spokesperson says Weston was not available for an interview. Gilpin says she's nervous about her future and heartbroken that the layoffs might affect the quality of Sesame Workshop's programs.
We're struggling to imagine how people that are remaining are going to be able to fulfill on this mission.
C is for Cookie Monster, D for dessert. Om nom nom nom.
New episodes of Sesame Street will continue streaming on Max until September. Sesame Workshop says production on season 56 starts next month, but it has yet to announce a new distributor. Elizabeth Blair, NPR News.
This is NPR News.
On the next Fresh Air, actor Simu Liu. He's best known for his breakout role as Shang-Chi, Marvel's first Asian superhero, and for playing a rival Ken in the film Barbie. He now stars with Woody Harrelson in the new film Last Breath, about deep-sea divers who perform a life-saving rescue. Join us.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from the Pew Charitable Trusts, telling stories behind data and trends that shape our world today through its podcast, After the Fact. Learn more at pewtrusts.org/afterthefact. From Arm, committed to delivering innovative advanced computing designed to enable worldwide companies to unleash the capabilities and experiences of AI. The future of AI is built on Arm. Arm.com. From Procter & Gamble, maker of ZzzQuil, with a range of products designed to relieve occasional sleeplessness to help people fall asleep. Learn more at ZzzQuil.com. And from the William T. Grant Foundation, supporting research to improve the lives of young people, at WTGrantFDN.org.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm A. Martinez.
I'm Steve Inskeep.
And I'm Leila Fadel. In her new book of essays, Sucker Punch, Slate writer Saatchi Kohl is going through a lot. Her marriage is falling apart, she's grappling with her self-worth, family pressures, and a rape she never really dealt with. Through it all, her instinct since childhood was always to fight, even to show love, until now.
I'm like angrier than ever, and I have a capacity for conflict that is the highest it's ever been, but I fight the least that I ever have.
Now, Kohl says she's far from zen, but she doesn't want conflict all the time anymore.
I do think I have at least learned a couple of things that I just won't do anymore.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't think I will any longer fight in relationships where I feel like I'm not being witnessed.
Well, how long have you been divorced now?
3 years.
3 years. So how is it?
I mean, I love divorce. Things, like, I think it's great. Nothing has given me more in this life than being divorced.
So much of this book is, or at least as I was reading, it's watching you and really relating to working through your relationship with men, your own self-worth, writing about your divorce, about your rape when you're barely of age and never really confronting it, about figuring out how to be alone. Did writing this book help you find a path to a calmer or more peaceful place?
Yeah, it was the only path. I was really disoriented after I started the divorce process. Every possible future building I've done in my head is not happening. I have just had to break bad news to everyone I know, because then you got to tell your friends. I had to tell my family. Like, that's a painful conversation.
And so you ultimately settled on making your divorce kind of the center of this book in some ways.
Yeah, I think divorce offered me a framework for rethinking everything. Like, I started getting tattooed after my divorce, and I remember showing my mom, and she just would roll her eyes and, like, insult me in four or five languages and then move on with her day. If I had done that before my divorce, she would have, like, been on the phone to God. She would have had a meltdown about it. But I've already done the thing that scared her so much, and it's fine. You know,
so you, like, got some freedom out of it.
Oh, yeah, a lot, a ton. It was the freedom I think I was trying to get before, and I couldn't. I had to do it this way.
Something that really, I think, was so vulnerable of you was the way that you talked about your own rape and the need to talk to the person who did it to you, to reconnect to that person, to search for something in them that would maybe make you feel okay about it. I mean,
yeah,
it was relatable and fascinating to read you write about it in that way.
When I sort of sat down and thought about, like, okay, I'm writing this book about divorce, and I'm writing a book about ultimately what I view as these betrayals of me and to me and by me, you know, I'm committing them to myself as well and to other people. I really did wake up on his 30th birthday and feel it. I felt like we were moving into a new phase of our lives, and I felt like, I think I almost felt resentful at the idea, what if he could forget? That doesn't seem fair.
Hmm.
I don't get to. So I think it started as, I just would like to make sure he remembers. I think he did.
Yeah. Your mom, Yeah. Is a big part of this book too. And you dedicate the book to, quote, my mom, obviously.
Obviously.
How did she influence Sucker Punch?
The divorce would have been very easy if I never had to tell my mother. When I left, it felt a little like I was leaving for both of us. She had like a consensual arranged marriage. She, you know, agreed to it, but she didn't know my dad very well. She got married at 24. Her mom got married at 14. So I also really abided by, I met someone young and I followed through. I did what I was supposed to do. And so it felt like I was taking her with me through the divorce in good and bad.
Yeah.
And then her illness landed right after my divorce was finalized. And then that felt cosmic and cruel and unyielding and felt like something, again, we had to do in lockstep.
So it is a collection of essays. And the first essay in this book, the first chapter, is called Parvati Stands in Flames. And the last, Kali Starts a Fire. So first, if you could just describe the differences between these two Hindu goddesses and how they represent your own evolution.
I will also say this is my very loose interpretation of these fables. I, in my divorce, was thinking so much about all of these, like, these female, these Hindu deities. And so I kept thinking about stories about Parvati and her transition. Parvati is kind of like the most human version of herself. And she falls in love with a boy, and her parents don't want her to marry him, even though he is also celestial. The story my mom used to tell me is that she stood in angry meditation for 1,000 years and waited until her parents said, okay, fine, you can marry him. And they did. And then through the book, we kind of visit Parvati, and as she changes, she becomes Durga, who is more of a fighter. She spooks people. She is the deity that comes in and she ends the universe. So, you know, Hindus believe in reincarnation. We believe that the universe basically restarts. But at a certain point, it doesn't. After she effectively kills everybody, she cannot access Parvati again. She cannot get back to who she was. And so her husband, one of the gods, not using his name because he's not important, he throws himself at her feet to, like, knock her out of it because he is now going to show her this show of devotion. He's going to offer it back to her. Mm. And when he does it, then she shrinks back down to size.
Wow.
So even in, like, the versions I had heard as a kid, these stories are still about marriage and a shared duty to each other. But they are obviously taught differently to girls and to boys. They're taught differently to different people in different families. These were not stories that I internalized until I left. And then I started really thinking about them and thinking about what it meant to start a fire.
Sachi Cole is a senior writer at Slate and the author of Sucker Punch. Thank you so much for talking to us about the book.
Thanks for having me.
This is NPR News.
Mickey Barnes is unexpendable. His job is to explore space, endure violent deaths, and be reprinted to die again.
You're Mickey 16?
17. Jerk.
And the inspiration for the aliens Mickey meets?
Croissant.
Croissants. I'm Ari Shapiro, director Bong Joon-ho on his wild new movie, Mickey 17, on the next All Things Considered from NPR News.
Live from NPR News, I'm Lakshmi Singh. The U.S. Department of Agriculture is bringing back nearly 6,000 employees who were told they were being fired because of performance problems. But as NPR's Andrea Hsu reports, many had excellent performance reviews.
investigators found the agency didn't even look at their performance, which is a requirement if you're going to fire workers during the probationary period in the federal government. Instead, the special counsel said the firings appear to be part of an attempt to shrink the government, which administrations can do, but they have to go through a bunch of procedures, including giving people 60 days notice, which the USDA did not do.
The European Union's holding emergency talks in Brussels about increasing their defenses in the event President Trump disengages with the U.S.'s longtime allies. European Commission President Ursula von der Leyen says Europe faces a clear and present danger.
Europe has to be able to protect itself, to defend itself, as we have to put Ukraine in a position to protect itself and to push for lasting and just peace.
Von der Leyen is heard on the BBC about a week after he visited the White House. French President Emmanuel Macron says he plans to speak with other European leaders about the possibility of using France's nuclear deterrent to protect the continent from Russian aggression in the event the U.S. dials back support to European allies. U.S. stocks trading lower this hour. This is NPR News. Canadian Prime Minister Justin Trudeau says his country will continue to be in a trade war with the U.S. for the foreseeable future. He blames the Trump administration for starting it. Trudeau addressed reporters in Ottawa as Commerce Secretary Howard Lutnick said all goods and services compliant with the U.S.-Mexico-Canada trade agreement will likely be excluded from tariffs for a month. On Tuesday, President Trump imposed 25% tariffs on Canadian imports. Canada responded with retaliatory levies. Trudeau accused Trump of trying to collapse Canada's economy and annex the country. He says annexation's never going to happen. South Korean fighter jets accidentally dropped bombs in civilian areas during a drill. NPR's Sewoon Gong reports from Seoul.
South Korea's Air Force said 8 unguided bombs fell outside a training range in Pochon, located 35 miles northeast of Seoul. The bombs were dropped from 2 KF-16 fighter jets participating in a live fire exercise. Local fire services said 13 civilians and 2 soldiers were injured. Several buildings and a cargo vehicle in the nearby area were also damaged. The military apologized and said its pilot put in the wrong coordinates. The Defense Ministry said all live fire drills will be suspended until it finds out exactly what went wrong.
Sewoon Gong reporting. It's NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from Fisher Investments. Fisher's dedicated team of specialists provide resources on investing, retirement income, estate planning, and more. Learn more at fisherinvestments.com. Investing in securities involves the risk of loss. From Indeed, committed to giving job listings increased visibility with relevant candidates through its sponsored jobs feature. Learn more at indeed.com/NPR. And from listeners like you who donate to this NPR station.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Amy Martinez in Los Angeles, California.
And I'm Steve Inskeep in Washington, D.C. Good morning. President Trump's administration has struggled to deport people as quickly as the president has demanded. The U.S. has changed leadership of the Immigration Enforcement Agency, tried and then stopped military flights to Guantanamo, and demanded more cooperation from cities and states. All of this is driving intense interest and fear in immigrant communities where some people have legal status and some do not. One organization in North Carolina is working to dispel rumors and that fear. Here's NPR's Jasmine Garst.
On a recent Monday morning, in the offices of Siembra, a nonprofit focused on immigrant worker rights based in Greensboro, North Carolina, the calls are starting to come in. Aimee Sarai Velasquez answers. She's the hotline coordinator.
Hola, buenas tardes. Soy Sarai, la coordinadora de la línea de Siembra.
The caller is at the doctor's office. She's seen law enforcement in the area.
Pues estaban afuera de un negocio y yo estaba pasando y lo vi.
She says she's not sure if it's immigration agents, but she sounds worried. The goal of the hotline is to fact check. Velasquez asks, did you see them yourself? Did the vests say police or something else?
Tenían como policía, or in English they say police.
She checks on the location of the call. It's coming from a county where local police do not cooperate with federal immigration agents. But the team still decides to send a volunteer to check if these are immigration agents. In this case, it's a false alarm. It almost always is. But if it were immigration agents, Siembra would send out a notice on social media and by text to over 20,000 people on a list, letting them know ICE agents are in this area. Efforts like these are taking place across the U.S. Border Czar Tom Homan has said they interfere with federal law enforcement. Here's Homan recently on the show Dr. Phil Primetime.
The old frame is knowing your rights. To me, in my view, you're helping a criminal escape apprehension.
But Siembra workers say they just want immigrants to live normal lives. Again, Aimee Sarai Velasquez.
Because we are here to stay. We are here. We're not going to be consumed by fear.
But a lot of the fear is based on real incidents. Recently in North Carolina, there was a sexual assault and a report of a violent burglary, both by people posing as federal immigration agents. And there have been actual arrests. About 2 weeks ago, Velasquez picked up this call on the hotline.
Hello? There's an ICE raid happening on Delafield Avenue in Durham. They're covering their faces, seeing people. They're walking this guy in the house in cuffs. And chains. There's a change. I'm sorry.
ICE said 11 migrants were arrested that day. Another dispatcher steps in and advises the caller to stand back.
You can just loudly remind the families who are probably inside their house scared, ask for a judicial warrant. And if you just keep saying that, then that'll just remind the family that they don't have to open the door.
ICE did not respond to NPR's questions about the Durham arrests. 11 out of about 300,000 immigrants without legal status living in North Carolina is a tiny number. But the immigrants NPR spoke to said they had heard about it and felt shaken. When the weekend rolls around, Velasquez leads Siembra staff in canvassing a mostly immigrant trailer park in Greensboro, reminding them to use the hotline. One neighbor pokes her head out her trailer door and says she watches the text alerts whenever she's out and about, but she's still scared. She doesn't have legal status to be in the U.S., so she asks that NPR use her first initial only, M.
Sí, por estar encerrado. Ahorita me salí para afuera y me dice mi hijo, mamá, entrese, no, le digo, yo quiero respirar aire.
When you knocked, M says, my son told me, mama, stay inside. But I need fresh air. All I do is stay locked in. Velasquez winces. Later on, she tells me when she was a child, her parents were in the country without legal papers. In the Obama years, when there was a historic number of deportations, she was told the same thing. Stay inside. She says she won't let it happen again.
We want for nuestra comunidad to continue living life. We're not going to not take the kids to school. We're going to continue going to work. It's a form of resistance to that fear.
No more hiding, she says. Not this time around. Jasmine Garst, NPR News, Greensboro, North Carolina.
An Idaho hospital is trying to keep the state's strict abortion ban on pause. The Biden administration had challenged the law, but the Department of Justice under President Trump moved to dismiss the suit on Wednesday. St. Luke's, the state's largest health care provider, anticipated this. It already has a similar suit against Idaho's attorney general. Reporter Julie Lucchetta has more.
The original lawsuit argued Idaho's law conflicts with the Federal Emergency Medical Treatment and Labor Act, or EMTALA, requiring hospitals receiving federal funding provide stabilizing care, which can include abortions. Idaho's ban only allows abortions in narrow cases of rape, incest, or if the mother's life is in danger. On Wednesday, U.S. District Judge Lynn Windmill heard arguments in St. Luke's case, filed earlier this year. The plaintiffs asked the judge to block the ban from applying to emergency situations while the case makes its way through the courts. That injunction would replace the one dropped by the Justice Department. St. Luke's argued state law could not supersede a federal mandate. The judge is expected to make a ruling on the injunction request within the next 2 weeks. The Attorney General's office declined to comment on pending litigation. Speaking after the hearing, St. Luke's counsel Peg Doherty said they want emergency doctors to be able to stabilize pregnant patients.
We want them to receive the emergency care that is available to anyone who presents to an emergency room. That is our goal.
The state said the abortion ban does not conflict with the federal mandate, arguing EMTALA only requires hospitals to screen and stabilize patients. Defendants said it cannot dictate standards of care beyond that. Dr. Kathleen Keaton is an OBGYN at a clinic affiliated with St. Luke's and attended the hearing. She pushed back against the state's arguments, saying stabilizing patients was not black and white.
That's not what we see as physicians. We see the impermanence of stability.
Especially, she said, because a pregnant woman's condition can change quickly and potentially threaten her life. OBGYN Ann Feiner attended the hearing and also works for a St. Luke's affiliate.
I do not think it should be my job in the middle of the night to figure out which law supersedes the other.
For NPR News, I'm Julie Duketa in Boise, Idaho.
This is NPR News.
Five years ago, American public life suddenly shut down. And even today, how you respond to COVID risk often depends on your politics. A new survey, next time here and now.
With everything from groceries to orthodontics, yes, really, available on demand, why not public radio? Make playing NPR or this station part of your smart speaker routine to stay informed on your schedule.
Good morning, I'm Steve Inskeep with a reminder to never give up. A bald eagle went in for the kill against a Canada goose. A photographer saw it happen and captured the action. Incredible photos show the big birds flapping wings and squawking. Then you see the eagle flying inches above the icy ground with a talon wrapped around the goose's head. But after 20 minutes, the eagle gave up and the Canada goose maintained its independence. It's Morning Edition.
Support for NPR comes from the station
And from Eric and Wendy Schmidt, through the Schmidt Family Foundation, working toward a healthy, resilient, secure world for all, on the web at theschmidt.org. From Jarl and Pamela Mohn, focusing on civil liberties, foster youth, public radio, and the arts. And from the Walton Family Foundation, working to create access to opportunity for people and communities by tackling tough social and environmental problems. More information is at waltonfamilyfoundation.org.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Steve Inskeep.
And I'm A. Martinez. A suburb of Damascus is at the center of the new Syrian government's struggle for control. One of its security officers was killed last week during a fight at a checkpoint, and now Israel is threatening to intervene, turning this possibly into an international incident. NPR's Jana Raff went there. She has more on what's been happening. Jane, so what's the importance of this suburb? Tell us about it.
Well, the issue here is there's a religious minority there. It's a suburb called Jeramana with a population of about 2 million, so a pretty big place, but it has a significant Druze minority. The Druze faith emerged about 1,000 years ago, and it's an offshoot of Shia Islam. And like many other minorities in Syria, many Druze supported the former regime. So up until last week, security was largely controlled by a Druze militia. But on Friday, there was a clash at a checkpoint, and a security officer of the new government was killed, the new forces belonging to the new government. The government then sent fighters in to surround the suburb.
The Israeli government described it as an attack on the Druze and said it could intervene to protect them there and in other places. Why is Israel involved?
Well, Israel has its own Druze minority in Israel itself and in Syrian territory it occupies. And some of the Israeli Druze actually serve in the Israeli military. But here it's very different. We spoke with a Druze official, Rabbi Munther, and here's what he said. He says, we reject being protected by anyone. We're protected by our people and our brothers in the homeland. That's the only protection we want.
Now, how much control does the new government actually have in the face of militias and threats from other countries?
Well, in Jeramana, Druze leaders agreed to allow those government security forces in. There haven't been any official security forces since the fall of the regime in a lot of places. In Jeramana, schools and government offices were closed because of fear of violence, but they reopened this week. There is essentially a security vacuum that was there. We did speak with the mayor and police chief, the same man who was appointed over the weekend. He's from Idlib in northwestern Syria. And that's where opposition fighters that led this fall of the regime came from. So the mayor, Mohammed Hamoud, sat in this dusty, bare office, and he told us the city still wasn't fully under control. He blamed weapons that the regime had left behind when they retreated, now in the hands of criminals, he said.
So if the Druze say they don't want protection, where would that leave Israel?
Well, there have been Israeli airstrikes on Syrian military targets, a kind of a wide array of them. So it's clearly not just about protecting the Druze, but Israel has warned Syria's new government not to deploy its own troops south of Damascus. And all of that has raised tensions with Turkey, which is the other major player in the region. It says it won't allow Israeli interference in Syria. And it's talking about building more Turkish bases in this country.
That's NPR's Jane Araf. Jane, thanks.
Thank you.
This is NPR News. It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm E. Martinez.
And I'm Steve Inskeep. Rural schools in Alaska are crumbling. The state has failed for almost two decades to provide money to fix leaky roofs, exposed wiring, and other health and safety issues. We know this thanks to an investigation by NPR, member station KYUK, and ProPublica. KYUK reporter Emily Schwing visited an Alaska town that I just looked up on Google Maps, one of those towns where, when you ask the route from Anchorage, there isn't one.
Every morning before kids in Sleep Mute head to class, Angela Hayden leads them in the Pledge of Allegiance.
I pledge allegiance to the flag.
This seems like a typical school day, but here in Sleep Mute, it's anything but.
The roof was leaking when I first started teaching here 17 years ago.
Hayden is the lead teacher and principal at the K-12 public school in this tiny, mostly Indigenous community of fewer than 100 residents. Nestled along the northern bank of the upper Kuskokwim River in Alaska's interior, Sleep Mute has no roads or shopping malls, and internet and phone service are spotty.
I figured coming to a remote place in Alaska, I'm probably going to be more than just a teacher. You have to have a lot of knowledge of so many different things just to survive and live out here.
Building maintenance is one of those things. Hayden's husband, Taylor, also helps with the school's upkeep. 2 years ago, he was under the building to fix the heating system when he discovered damage caused by a leaking roof.
I mean, you can see the water has migrated in here from the snow melt throughout the course of the winter.
There's a huge pool of water in front of us, and a block of concrete that's supposed to hold up part of the building has crumbled.
Yeah, just like somebody took a jackhammer to it.
In 2021, an architect hired by the Kuspuk School District to assess this building said it should be condemned. Since then, the boys' bathroom, the gymnasium, and the wood shop have all been closed. Now students are relegated to the front of the building, where teacher Cherie Smith says bats occasionally terrorize them.
Everybody was quietly reading their books, and then we saw the bat flying around our classroom, and then we went to get a tennis racket out of the gym, and it came out into the hallway, and I smacked it down with a tennis racket.
Unlike most school districts in the U.S., Alaska's rural districts don't have a tax base to fund schools, so they rely on the state. Alaska owns just under half of the schools, including Sleep Mute, and is required by law to fix them. In 2007, the Kuspuk School District asked for $411,000 to fix the roof in Sleep Mute. They've asked 18 more times. Today, that request has grown to more than $1.6 million. Madeline Aguillard is superintendent.
We've also tried to remedy, you know, the conditions on our own. However, the equipment doesn't exist within some of our communities. The resources aren't there.
Nearly all of Alaska's rural public school districts serve communities that are predominantly Indigenous. It's a population that has historically been discriminated against in education. In the 1990s, a group of Alaska Native parents sued the state, arguing the way it funds rural public school infrastructure violated Alaska's constitution and the Federal Civil Rights Act. A judge determined the state had a responsibility to provide education to Alaska Native children. Bryce Edgman, an independent, is the speaker of Alaska State House and an Alaska Native.
We have not upheld our constitutional duty to provide quality of education that we're bound to providing.
Occasionally, a tile falls from the ceiling while students attend classes in Sleep Mute.
This one right here fell down a long time ago. I don't know when this one fell down.
Last spring, kindergartner Nolan Adam Smith pointed them out when he gave a tour of his classroom.
And it's been leaking.
Oh, it's been leaking. Is that why that bucket is there?
Yeah, that bucket's all because it's been leaking.
Smith and his classmates have never been inside a classroom that didn't have water damage in the ceiling or mold in the walls. Andrea John has three kids enrolled in the Sleep Mute School.
They should have helped us when we needed help in the beginning, not wait 20 years. Those city people, they wouldn't let their kids go to school here. Would you let your kids come to school here?
John knows the school is unsafe and unhealthy. But she also refuses to deprive her kids of their education. She says it's simply too easy for the state to overlook a tiny rural community like hers.
We have no choice because they're dragging their asses and they're choosing to look the other way and stay the hell with us.
Last June, Sleepmute got some good news. The state finally approved its roof repair after legislators passed a bill that funded school maintenance and construction to its highest level in more than a decade. But Superintendent Aguillard says the Sleepmute school is beyond repair. For NPR News, I'm Emily Schwing in Sleepmute, Alaska.
You ever thought about running a marathon?
Me? No, yeah. Too many sweaty people too close to me. No. You.
But you've got the skill. You can do it, man.
Yeah, probably.
Probably. But yeah. You may not be able to get a spot in the TCS New York City Marathon in November because organizers say more than 200,000 people have applied through a lottery, which is a record, and only about 3% will get in, which is an acceptance rate for this marathon roughly equal to the chance of getting into Harvard.
It's hard to get in, which makes people want to try to get in.
Justine Huang runs for fun and makes TikToks about it. She went viral last year, Steve. Listen to this. After running the marathon drunk.
The entire city's a party that day. So it's just probably one of the best days in the world.
And lots of people want in.
I mean, especially in New York, there are 1,000 different run clubs that you can join. I think I'm part of 10 different ones at least.
That's Audrey Corrigan, a former college athlete who runs every morning before heading for an office job.
And New York can be so expensive. I think it's a nice free way to exercise and make friends, meet people, build relationships.
Now, Corrigan skipped the lottery because she can get in through the New York Roadrunners 9+1 program.
Basically, you run 9 road races and you volunteer at 1.
And Justine Huang is counting on a third way to make this year's cut.
I think I'll try to find my way there somehow, whether it's through a club or even if I find a charity to fundraise for.
Okay, so you can fundraise, you can do the lottery, you can do the run club, all to get your shot. And I mean get a shot at running a marathon, not doing
not
shots.
Not the other shot.
That's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Steve Inskeep.
And I'm Amy Martinez.
Start running.